Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer. Matt Doyle is here. Kalen Carr is here. It is November 21st, 2024. The conference semifinals are upcoming this weekend. Saturday, two games. Hudson River Derby at 5:30 p.m. Eastern. LAFC Seattle, again, at 10:30. And on Sunday, Orlando, Atlanta. Orlando, our favorites at 3:30. And the Galaxy take on Minnesota United at 6 p.m. Eastern. We are going to go through an absolute laundry list of news in this show before we ever even get to the previews. Tata Martino has walked away from Inter Miami for personal reasons. There's a new head coach in Dallas. He is familiar to that organization. Wilfried Nancy is your Siggy Schmidt Coach of the Year. And there are some movers and shakers in Montreal and Atlanta and Nashville. And FC Cincinnati have set the MLS transfer record, which we mentioned last show, but didn't really dive into. Kevin Denke is official for upwards of $16 million. Boys, what's up? I've been doing a little bit of, I've been doing some Instagram reporting. Kalen, and I gotta say, you showing people at the bar your MLS Cup goal, it's a little unbecoming.
No, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. That was set up. Kiel caught me in a vulnerable moment. We were breaking something. I don't know how that happened, but also, where were you at? We were at the pub. I heard you were in the studio yesterday and didn't actually come to the hang afterwards.
Me? In the studio? Yeah, I was there for a hot second. You guys were so busy doing this.
The issue,
I'm just so excited to watch that on YouTube. I didn't want to. You're in a flow.
Weeby doesn't do back-to-backs, right? He's a Kansas guy, so he can't show up 2 days in a row. Not like you and me. Us, we are ready to go every day of the week. Not Andrew Weeby, though.
Now, see, the way that this analogy works that you're not quite wrapping your head around is like, yeah, I might not do back-to-backs. I might have a problem showing up on time to meetings, but we're all 2-11, Doyle. Like, your record is my record. You can't walk away. Like, this is a team game, dog. Like, just because I'm Joel Embiid doesn't mean that you're basking in glory right now.
I don't know. I feel pretty good as a Celtics fan. I feel pretty good about the way the past month has gone. So, we'll see.
Okay. Anyway, that's a great moment, Kalen. I'm glad you got to relive that with your best friends. I'll just watch that on my own here later on. Just, you know, just to jog the memory.
If you're a listener to Extra Time and you've never seen Kalen Carr's MLS Cup goal from 2012, you should Google it because it's like Star Trek evil Kalen Carr. You know how sometimes Star Trek universe, there's like the evil Spock.
I thought this was going to be a compliment. Yeah.
The evil Spock has like a goatee. Like that is who scored the goal for the Houston Dynamo. And then this man celebrates by running over to the corner flag, hurdling the corner flag, and then turning around to celebrate with his team, does not crack a smile even once. It is all business with
Would
this
you
guy.
Celebrate if it wasn't the supporter shield, man, at stake? So why would you, what's there to celebrate?
It's just a glorified friendly. It's a fair point.
That's fair. Like you'd already lost the big one. This is just to sort of like have some self-respect at the end of the season. Look, it's the end of the season for Inter Miami. And unfortunately for Tata Martino, that's where we need to start. Or maybe fortunately, because perhaps walking away is what he really needed in this moment. Tom Bogert dropped the bombshell earlier this week. Tata Martino walking away from Inter Miami after a year and a half for personal reasons, after winning League's Cup, after winning the Supporters' Shield and setting the points record, it ended. It's over. Like, as quickly as it began, it seemed like. It came out of nowhere for many people. It is the third time that Tata and Lionel Messi have been together, worked together, not gotten the outcome that they wanted, both with Argentina, Barcelona, and now Inter Miami, and then parted ways. Doyle, what do you make of all this? I mean, in some ways, it just puts the pressure and the stakes and, you know, the singular project of Inter Miami and managing Lionel Messi in Major League Soccer in perspective. There was only one outcome that was acceptable, and even that might not have saved Tata Martino's job.
Yeah, from what I understand, there were there was real friction in the locker room over the second half of the season. There, the cadre of Barcelona guys not super happy with what the team had become tactically, had heard that there was even some sort of streaming match between Tata and I think Jordi Alba in the lead up to this game. The vibes were bad. So to your point, I think even if they had won MLS Cup, Tata probably would have walked away at the end of this one. The fact that he didn't, the fact that they lost in the first round to an Atlanta team that they frankly should have crushed, made the decision that much easier. And this was mutual. Like I, they did a good job of framing it as, you know, personal decision for Tata and, you know, everybody's saying the right things. But this was not, you know, I don't think there was any outcome where he would have stuck around for 2025. And the whole thing feels like it's in a little bit of flux, but I still look at this roster and I still see like the best roster in the league heading into next season. They're not going to be a ton of changes, and the ones that could happen, like if they sell Diego Gomez and they get rid of like one of the other U22s and Suarez and Jordi Alba are willing to come back on TAM deals, like they could add Neymar to this group. They really could do that. So this team is going to be fine no matter who manages them. But I have a feeling the little guy wearing the number 10 is going to have a big say on who actually is going to be the manager.
Now, Doyle, you said you don't foresee a ton of changes, but isn't that sort of the DNA of this club? And even as you walked through, like, well, if this happens and that happens, doesn't that still portend a ton of changes, whether it's on the back line or in the way they construct the U22s or how the DP spots get filled or who decides that they should or need to be a DP? Like, isn't change just the DNA of Inter Miami at this point? Like,
I don't think what you described is like an inordinate amount of changes year over year. Like we're talking two, maybe three new starters, which is not, to me, that's not a ton. And if you look at the way, like the one thing Tata did a phenomenal job with this year, and nobody should have a word of criticism for him about this, is he used the entire roster. So they're going to have, even if they sell Diego Gomez, trade Julian Gressel, you know, get rid of David Martinez and bring in whichever Argentine center back they want to bring in to sort of anchor that back line. Like they are still going to have 22 other players on the roster next year who played meaningful minutes this year and often played them pretty well. So that, like, there is going to be a level of cohesion and consistency with this group that is going to stay in place even under the new manager, which at this point it's going to be Javier Mascherano, right? Like those are the two very, very obvious names.
What do you think, Kaelin? What was your first reaction when the I don't know if you're on Blue Sky yet, came down from old Tommy Scoops?
No, I'm not on Blue Sky yet. But my first reaction was like, oh, does this mean the supporter shield is maybe not enough to hold a group together? Because I had assumed that once you win, sorry, I can't help it, guys. It just this is twice already in the beginning of this of this episode. But
they would be strays if you didn't have it. You know, the sights
like
on
MLS
the shield all the
Cup
time
is the focus here, and if it's not that, it's not good enough. And I think that is really kind of the crux of this thing is like if. And I have bigger questions now about this Messi and Miami project overall of like, where does this leave them moving forward?
You're not as positive on it going into next year as I am.
No, because let's rewind the clock. They were one of the worst teams in the league. And then they had Messi come in. And then immediately the next day, they like were a different team, go on to win League's Cup, but then can't make the playoffs, right? So you're saying, okay, well, fine. You see enough there to say this is going to work out the next year. And then this year, they go on. They have, you know, go all the way, supporter shield, points record, which, by the way, is probably just going to get broken in the next few years either. Also,
they're going to break it. I'm calling it now. They're going to break it next year.
Okay. And if not, then I think somebody else will break. The points record for me is one of those where I feel like it's been broken every few years over the past few years. So I don't think there's going to be like a 20-year record that holds on forever, whether it's Miami or another club. But the other point is like they lose to Atlanta and in a best of three format. So for me, it takes time to be able to go and win MLS Cup. We saw even with Tata Martino in Atlanta, year one, everything jumped off the page. Almiron, Joseph Martinez, but they got punched in the mouth by Columbus in the first round, lost on penalties at home. And then the next year they go and stick together and win MLS Cup. So I have not seen teams that are just able to like add a new manager, bring in Xavi, bring in whoever. Even throughout the season, the entire roster is changing constantly, players coming in, players coming out. And I expect more of that to happen next season, but I just don't know if that's going to be enough to then get all the way to the top and get to MLS Cup, which is, you know, going back to the David Beckham teams and those MLS Cups highlights that we were watching, like those were the teams that ended up winning back-to-back titles. They had won Supporter Shield, but ultimately you have to win MLS Cup for this Inter Miami project to be realized to its full potential. And you only have maybe 1 year with Messi left. We don't know after that. I wouldn't take that for granted. So that's a quick window for Xavi, whoever, to come in and try to sort this thing out, to realize this project to where we think it can all get to, or where it should get to. And I'm surely not going to say they're not the favorites. They're definitely the favorites to get in. They were the favorites this year. That was the exact same way. And they fell on their face in front of the whole world with Atlanta United, and credit to them. But I'm not sure that this actually makes them closer. If anything, I feel like it takes them a step further away from that final goal.
I hear what you're saying. The flip side I would say is, because of that shortened window, you cannot stick with something that either organizationally or individually within that squad, people don't believe is going to take you to the promised land of MLS Cup. Like, if you don't think Inter Miami, Lionel Messi, fill in the blank, Messi's friend, anybody with influence, the Moss brothers, or Tata himself, that this is the right solution to get you over the finish line, you don't have time to dwell on it. You don't have time to think, well, I don't know, let's waffle a little bit. Like, what is the right solution? Like, in Miami's position, like, they're in a trigger pulling moment. Like, if it doesn't work, make the change. And we saw that throughout the entire season in 2024. Center back's hurt. Center back's not working. This player isn't the guy that you want him to be. Julian Gressel in the playoffs, whatever. Make the change. Do the thing. Like, you have to fix it absolutely right now. So if Tata wasn't that guy, or if he was burnt out on the whole situation, or if he didn't think he had another year in him, well, then you got to make the move. And the flip side on, like, you know, Xavi and Mascherano, Xavi's the one for me that is like, okay, well, you know, Tata was hired in the first place because he was the guy who was available, who had Messi experience, who had MLS experience, who had the resume and sort of the wherewithal to take this project on in its first year and a half. And there were growing pains and a lot of, you know, different strings and threads to pull during that time. I do think, to Doyle's point, it is a little bit more settled now. What it's going to be like with Messi, how the organization is going to work with Messi. So now maybe is the good time to say, hey, Xavi, you weren't available. You were with Barcelona. You're the logical choice. It's all settled for you to come in and try to win. You have a full preseason. You have a full year to go do it. Like, and you've got to do it. And that's sort of the crux for this club, is like, you have to win MLS Cup, because if you don't, to me, it's even bigger than when, you know, David Beckham was sort of fighting against the tides to try to get the job done. And eventually Bruce Arena's continuity helped him get there. He was early 30s. Messi's 37. You're absolutely right, Kalen. It might be just next year. So if you don't do it, I mean, that's a failure. That's the biggest failure in MLS history, in my opinion. If you bring Messi into the league, if you spend all this money and bring his friends and you don't win MLS Cup, so every decision you make has to have one North Star, and that is, will it help us win MLS Cup?
So when you say every decision you make, who's the you at this point? Because this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, is that you know, I've talked to people in Miami who have said it's like Game of Thrones here, in terms of like six different people vying for having their hand on the tiller in terms of who's steering the ship. And that is, to me, a much bigger concern, because that kind of chaos in the front office, that trickles down. And I think that is a much bigger concern to me than who's going to be the coach next year, because I honestly think any half decent coach, provided that they go out and get at least one good veteran center back, can coach this team to 70 points and you know, be the favorites in the playoffs. But what happens in the front office, the way they go about keeping this roster together, like that is what's really up in the air at this point. And we've said it on this show a million times. Like, we all kind of expect Chris Henderson to head up to Atlanta because there is a CSO job open there. And he's one of those guys who sort of kind of fighting for his life. I mean, he's fighting for his say in roster construction with this Miami team. Like, they brought in dudes over him who have like zero experience. So it's like, I am much more concerned about all of that than I am about the roster, the coach, and what happens. But to your point, Weeby, like, this is, if they don't get it done next year, it's failure with a capital F, and it's one that it will stain the resume of literally every person involved.
I don't think it's a given that Henderson walks away. I think, again, that just goes to the sort of singular nature of the project. Atlanta fans won't love to hear that, but like, when you're involved in making history, I do think it's difficult to walk away. And the flip side of that is Inter Miami would be absolutely out of their minds to let that man leave the building. Like, the way that they're having to chop and change and fit within this, you know, structure. Bro,
they made him change his office.
I get it.
The new club president came in and said, you got to work in the broom closet.
I get it. I'm just saying, if he walks away, you're insane, Inter Miami. Like, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't, to my point about the North Star being MLS Cup, that doesn't get you closer to that North Star. It makes the job harder for you.
That's tough when someone, like, your locker's just gone. You just show up. That happen, actually. It's tough. It's
like, I mean, this is a hard job. I mean, for any manager that comes in, and I think it's hard, not just in soccer terms, because to credit Tata once again, I mean, he did incredible things. To me, the part that I'm most impressed with is not the part where you have Messi and you win games with Messi. It's the part where you don't have Messi and Suarez and you don't miss a beat. Like, that's the part that inevitably another manager will have to replicate in some way, because Messi and Suarez and Busquets and Alba, to a lesser degree, probably won't be available all year. Now, it is good news for them that next year is not a international heavy tournament year, which puts additional pressure on them.
Club World Cup. What do you think?
They do have the Club World Cup.
I forgot. Yeah, Club. Hey, forgot about that one.
I mean, honestly, if you look at
Supporters Shield, it is truly the
If you look at Miami's schedule, and they do what they want to do, this is a team that's going to play 55 games next year. So they're going to have to go down that roster, and they're going to have to get contributions from guys deep near the end of that roster, just in the way that they did this year.
Any final thoughts? I mean, I guess my final thought would just be the same measurements that they failed in this year. And the reason why Tata Martino is, you know, outside the personal reasons, is probably gone. Failure in CONCACAF Champions Cup, failure in MLS Cup playoffs. I mean, those are the measuring sticks next year. To your point, Kalen, they got the points record. They got the shield. Like, that is old news. The only thing that matters is winning knockout round competitions and lifting trophies, and for Lionel Messi to be the one lifting the trophy in the front of that mob.
The biggest thing for me is what you hit on with Henderson and what I think Tata brought, which was MLS experience, institutional experience. And that does not sound like the direction things are going. And that would be something I would be looking at as like a key indicator of what their offseason looks like and how they are able to kind of retool. You can bring in all the big players in the world, bring in the biggest managers, but this is different. This is a different setup. And I think that knowledge is really important if you want to actually get over the hump.
Who's going to be the coach, Doyle?
I think it'll be Xavi or Mascherano. Those are the two guys who make the most sense given where they are in their careers and you know, who they are in terms of their background with Messi, Busquets, Alba, and Suarez. And one note about Tata, sources close to him told me that he's going to Argentina for 6 months to relax and unwind. But come summer, he's going to want to coach again. So I think, like, once managers in MLS start losing their job, and like, he likes MLS. So once managers in MLS start losing their jobs, he is going to be a guy whose name is at or near the top of every single list. So keep that in your back pocket, and hopefully we'll talk about it on the show in June.
Man, Tata, after his time with Mexico and then Inter Miami, You deserve that 6 months, dog. You deserve that 6 months. Like, you know, slow sip some mate, get the asado going, just relax. Tranquilo, my man. All right, some news around the league before we jump into these previews. I mentioned it. I voted for Tata Martino. I still feel good about that vote, but I'm extremely excited for Wilfried Nancy to get the Siggy Schmidt Coach of the Year. He deserves it. I thought he should have won it in the year with FC. Well, now I'm just confusing all the different iterations of Montreal. We'll talk about them in a second. And his year with, was it then? That, was still the Impact then? Or
nah, I think
no, it was CF Montreal. Yeah. But it might have been Club Foot Montreal at that
point. It might have been the foot. I think it was Club de Foot. Anyway, deserve it for Wilfried Nancy. Doyle, what is the big takeaway from the players basically making the difference in the voting to get Wilfried his coach of the year?
You know, we give Nancy a lot of credit for how brave his team is, and specifically with the ball and against all comers, and how they want to invite pressure from opposing back lines, opposing front lines, bring them upfield and play through it. Use your skill, use your combination play with your teammates. It's a beautiful style of soccer to watch. And I think players want to play like that. They want to be challenged like that. Sean Zawadzki, I think it was, you know, early this season, or maybe it was even in the middle of last season, said, yeah, I was used to just getting the ball off my foot as quickly as possible in midfield. And Wilfried Nancy came to me and said, you shouldn't do that. You need to take more touches. You need to actually bring the defenders to you. And how that just like opened up this whole new world for Sean Zawadzki in terms of how he could play the game. And we've seen it happen with guys like Max Arfston and Mo Farsi, and like they were on nobody's radar, and now here they are amongst the very best in the league at their position. But he also gets this out of guys like Diego Rossi and of course Cucho Hernandez. So his ability to instill that in basically every player he's ever coached, there's a line of guys who would love to play for him. It's very obvious. And I happy for him that they won or that he won Coach of the Year, because I thought he deserved it. And I frankly think he deserved it each of the past 3 years. I think he's just one of one.
Congratulations.
The biggest thing for me... The biggest thing I would say just to add is like, it's gotten to the point where I've seen players in other places and been like, yeah, it's not quite working out, but what would it look like under Wilfried Nancy? And I think that, you know, that's the, from an individual standpoint. And then
the players have actually said that to you.
No, that's just when I'm watching guys in other places. Yeah. And I'm sure there's a lot of guys that he won the player vote. So I was thinking like, a lot of these guys are like, yeah, I would love to play that way, because you don't often hear that where it's like, hey, play brave, trust yourself. You generally hear that in preseason. But then once, you know, the matches start, it's like, hey, don't make a mistake. And he's consistently getting guys to, you know, trust themselves, to reach new levels. I just think what he's done over the, like, I know we're not supposed to count the other competitions, but I can't help it. The way we saw in Leagues Cup, the way we saw it in CONCACAF Champions Cup, like he that's why I voted for him as well. And look, I think he's sort of a unicorn of managers that we've seen in MLS this year. And the part that I also think that maybe isn't quite as talked about as much, because he is such a tactician, is the man management side of
it. I agree.
And he's gotten the belief from all these guys. He's made tough decisions. He suspended Cucho. He's brought him back into the team. He's subbed for subs with AZ Jackson and then got him to play his best towards after that in the rest of the regular season. So he's just really pulled all the right strings that has the trust and belief from the guy. So I think the playoff didn't work out obviously the way that they wanted to, but I think this was a great decision to see him get recognized at this point.
I think for the sickos, the thing that I would go back to is, you know, you have Tata, we're talking about Xavi and Mascherano, and oh, Dean Smith comes into the league, and oh, look at that. But ultimately, Wilfried, you know, outside of his playing career and his coaching career, he's a homegrown man. Like, yeah. That's where I take a ton of pride, just in Major League Soccer and watching him make this rise and get opportunities and take advantage of the opportunities, and just knowing, hey, every single thing you got, you worked your butt off for, and you got it when you deserved it. And you set new precedents in this league in a lot of different ways, in the way that this team plays, in results, certainly at the Crew and at Montreal, but, you know, also, you know, I think in just who he is and what he represents. I mean, you know, he's talked about being, you know, the first Black coach to win MLS Cup. I mean, he's carried that mantle, but he's done it in his own way. And I think that's my biggest compliment to him, is he's always stayed very true to what he thinks the most important principles of the game are and of life are, because he's much deeper than just soccer when you talk to him. And to have that personality at the top of our league and have come from within our league as a coach, I think is a feather that we should all be proud to have in the cap of Major League Soccer. So congratulations to Wilfred. Big season coming up next year. I just hope he's with us, because God knows he's going to be in demand. There's already some whispers about Ligue 1, et cetera. And congratulations, FC Dallas. They've hired their new manager, Eric Quill from New Mexico United. He is new in terms of their head coaching job, but not new in terms of the organization. He was the guy who basically got North Texas up and running, won a League One title with that team. He's a longtime youth soccer coach in Texas. He was a Crew assistant for a little bit before he went to New Mexico, had a great season with them in the USL Championship last year. And we talked on this show about how Dallas need to get back to their soul of who they are as a club. Somebody who really understood that soul of player development, of what it meant to be in that part of North Texas, and how you could sort of marry all these different attributes that the club could put together to be their best selves. And, you know, Peter Luxain had a lot of those attributes, right? He was in the academy. He was a part of the second team. But I think Eric Quill for them was always the guy who best embodied it. So it makes sense that they've decided to bring him back. And yeah, I'm excited to see what he can do. He's saying all the right things about playing attacking, exciting soccer. That's what basically every coach says when they come in, but he's got a track record of doing it at New Mexico and in developing talent and winning with North Texas, some of the biggest names now with the U.S. men's national team and who have been sold overseas. So I think a good hire from Dallas. Any thoughts on him?
If it wasn't going to be Luxain, then Quill was the obvious guy for all the reasons you listed, having developed or helped develop players like Ricardo Pepi, Chris Richards, you know, all on through that great.
Tessman is a part of that as well. Yep, and yep.
That great academy cohort that they had. The cohort since then hasn't been as strong. And that's, I think, going to be part of the job, is to find a way to get contributions from that anyway. It might end up being one of the tougher parts of the job. They played good soccer at New Mexico United this year. They won a lot of close games. They weren't overwhelming by any means, but finished first in the USL Championship Western Conference, and also put together a really nice US Open Cup run. So there's a little bit of knockout round juice that he's got there as well. It makes a lot of sense. I really liked a lot of what I saw from Peter Luxain. I thought his team played brave, to borrow the term that we use when talking about how Wilfred Nancy's team played. Maybe it was too brave too quick, given that Luxain was taking over from Nico Estevez, whose team was very conservative, almost the opposite in terms of their approach. And Luxain's team left themselves vulnerable at the back. And that's what ended up costing them. And if you look at it, I think they were 8-10-3 across all competitions when once he took over. Lost in the Open Cup against Sporting Kansas City, lost in two games in the League's Cup, which was, you know, St. Louis City and I think Juarez, and like that wasn't good enough. And especially because you know, the ownership had said we're prioritizing those games. So you look at that, and then the way they collapsed down the stretch, it wasn't quite good enough. But I hope we get to see Luxain somewhere again in MLS, because I really enjoyed watching that team the second half of the season, and I did not enjoy it at all the first half of that season.
New Mexico United becomes a job that I think MLS assistants are going to be looking at potentially as a jumping off spot. Certainly a big job in USL Championship. Speaking of USL Championship, just want to congratulate Pa Motuka for being named the new Phoenix Rising head coach. So congratulations to him. I have this question for you, Kalen, in Dallas and in Austin, because we haven't really talked as much about Nico Estevez, though we will get to that in depth. Which Texas team should be more excited about their new coach, Austin or Dallas? What do you think?
I think Dallas, from the standpoint of it's a bit awkward, I think, with taking a manager from a rival. And then also to Doyle's point, what it looked like for Dallas was not, you know, really what you would inspire you to move forward. And so it's a bit of a surprise in that standpoint with Estevez going over to Austin. The other part that I think is unique about, you guys mentioned the youth development part, but I think that Quill is going to try to play a little bit quicker and to get out in transition more and get this team moving, which I think as somebody it's played in Texas, like that style, there's a certain unique style that you can play there and that you can actually take advantage of and use that to your advantage. I think he's from, with Quill being from Texas, having come through the academy, you know, bringing those young players along. Dallas is actually spending, you know, went out and got Petr Musa. They have Velasco and Ferreira right now, at least we'll see what happens if those guys get transferred or not. But the idea that you can then reignite this academy, go out in across Texas, because you got to remember some of these guys are not from Dallas, right? Like Ricardo Pepi's from El Paso. So you need somebody who understands the landscape all around and, you know, this sort of pro development pathway, which they brought all these players through to go all the way through North Texas to the first team. But you have to have somebody that ultimately believes in these young players and will give them a chance. And so I think he's going to be a good fit in that standpoint. And so I think if you had to pick between the two teams with the top end spend, the youth academy setup, and somebody who understands that, I could understand why Dallas fans would probably be more excited from this pick.
Atlanta United still looking for their head coach, obviously. Rob Valentino just FEA crushing it in the playoffs and still alive. So it makes sense that we haven't heard much on that front. But a guy is now to the mix, Doyle. Patrick Vieira is headed to Genoa. So what next for Atlanta United? Do the internal extra time odds makers now put Jim Curtin atop that list?
I mean, unless Rob Valentino goes on and wins the whole dang thing, then yeah, at this point I would be surprised if Jim Curtin wasn't the next head coach for Atlanta United, given the level of success he had on a budget in Philadelphia, given that it was reported by Tom and others that Atlanta actually wanted to interview Jim this summer for the head coaching position, and he turned them down because he was that committed to Philadelphia. I have to imagine that door is still open. So it's, the man checks a lot of boxes, right? The level of success that he has had, his ability to develop talent, his ability to manage veterans. The one thing he hasn't done is maybe manage the type of stars that I would expect to see Atlanta United bring in this winter. But it's also like that's a culture setting thing from the top down. And if you have a culture that you're confident in, then you're probably confident in your coach's ability to handle said star. So I think I would be kind of surprised if it wasn't, and I don't have any information, like any background info or inside information on this, but like, I would be surprised if it wasn't Jim Curtin. Though again, if Rob Valentino pulls a Schmetzer and wins this thing next month, then yeah, it'll be his job.
We were talking about change with Inter Miami, and I just want to say that we were not fair to them because Montreal is the club of change, and we have yet more in Montreal. I just saw their...
Oh, let me just add this thing. I have heard it will not be Tata in Atlanta because there were rumors about that immediately yesterday upon Tata and Miami splitting up. There's not going to be a reunion with Tata in Atlanta.
All right. Montreal, I don't know what to say other than Corey Ray is named the director of soccer, but it seems like there's a triumvirate there with Luca and Simone Saputo covering other different parts of the sporting structure, but they've now sort of figured that out after a year of uncertainty after Olivier Renard left earlier this season. There were a bunch of different roster decisions that popped down, including decisions on assistant coaches, Laurent Courtois, the goalkeeper coach, the fitness coach, a bunch of guys aren't returning, and a bunch of players aren't returning, including Joseph Martinez and others that have been stalwarts in Montreal. I just never know how it's going to work there until it starts working, and then inevitably
can we layer in the Succession opening theme music while we're reading that about the two sons getting
it's really fascinating.
Shiv gonna show up in this as well? Like, what's going on?
I I love Montreal, the city. I love Montreal, the club. No matter what their name is in this league, I love Stade Saputo. I love following this team because you just don't know. So I hope it all works out, because when they're good, it is so good in that city. And when they're bad, it's still interesting. So TBD for 2025 and beyond. Meanwhile, FC Cincinnati, Kaylin, are you new MLS transfer record holders? It's taken us 35 minutes to get to this news on Kevin Denke, which tells you everything about the state of Major League Soccer in 2024. Money is flying around. We've gotten accustomed to the likes of even $16.2 million exchanging hands. And FC Cincinnati doing it is not particularly a surprise. This is an ambitious club. It's a club that has put their marker down. And Kevin Denke is 23. Look, he's 24 in like 9 days. So he's 24 if we're going to get dogmatic about age. But he is a early prime, proven striker, Belgian League Golden Boot winner. This is a huge, huge move for Cincinnati and shows just what they're aiming for in 2025.
Yeah, this one felt like it almost slipped under the radar, but it really shouldn't, because you set the record in transfer fee. And you know, that's the part about Cincinnati that's impressed me so much, is even looking towards last season where I was like, oh, every free agent wants to go there. That's the place where they're flying in Miles Robinson when you're expecting them to go abroad or to Europe. And they're, we've gotten accustomed to maybe saying, okay, well, yeah, maybe LAFC or Inter Miami are grabbing players, the Galaxy, but you're looking at Cincinnati, you're saying they're competing with top teams around the world for signatures, of rumors of where they were going in for Weston McKennie, Denke for me, where he's there. You look at the clubs that they transfer players to, and you're like, this, he could go to a top four league and compete right away. The top scorer in the Belgian Pro League at 23, 24 years old is huge to be able to get to come to you. And Cincinnati all summer, even when I was there calling games, were out in the market working, trying to add for this season. And clearly it didn't quite work out in the way they wanted to be able to add that final piece. But the ambition to go back again and then to lock this down already is massive for them heading towards next season. Questions about Lucho, but if I'm Lucho, I know Denke was at their final match. The idea of having that sort of striker in front of him to put him behind, to create space and to have that final partnership that they've been searching for, this has to put them right at the top next year as far as contenders once again, and you know, maybe one of the best strikers in the league.
I think that Chris Albright and that front office deserve a lot of credit, because they've identified, I'm not going to call it a market inefficiency, but maybe a market opportunity here, because we all know that Belgium is one of the best developmental leagues in Europe, but the best developmental players in that league tend to get bought by teams in big five leagues by the age of 20 or 21. And guys who are 23, 24, 25 years old actually get overlooked by La Liga, Serie A, Premier League teams. They just don't have those opportunities. And MLS teams can pay more than, like, they could pay better salaries than Belgian League can. And so there's an opportunity to get a player like Denke, whereas 6-7 years ago, at age 23, there was just no chance. I guess the floodgates opened a little bit with Alejandro Pozuelo, because remember, he was the Belgian player of the year when Toronto brought him in 2019. But also, he was a little older. He was, I think, 28 by that time. So going, you know, to early prime instead of late or mid prime, that feels like something new. But now he's going to have to show it on the field. As good as he's been, it's no guarantee, because like Dante Van Zier was really good in Belgium. Hugo Kuipers was really good in Belgium. And like Van Zier has been a bust, and Kuipers was only okay in his first year with the Fire. The most successful forward to come from Belgium is actually Alonso Martinez, who wasn't even a forward in Belgium and had to change positions in MLS. So it's not a guarantee, but I like what I've seen from the player on film. I have a couple of Belgian friends. The scouting reports are all glowing. His underlying numbers are fantastic. And most importantly here, the process was really good. the process for Cincinnati to identify, bring him in, and get it done early, I think is really, really impressive. And if you keep your processes good, your team is probably going to stay good, even in the midst of some turmoil with, say, for example, your MVP caliber number 10.
I find it hard watching FC Cincinnati work to be satisfied with any excuse by any quote-unquote mid-market or small-market MLS club that says they can't go out and compete in the transfer window and get the level of players that, say, an LA or a Miami or New York are able to attract. I find it very hard to buy those excuses, given what Cincinnati and Columbus and others have managed to accomplish. It's fine if you say, we just don't want to spend at that level. That's fine. Just say that. But if you're willing to spend, if you have the front office and the facilities and the ambition and the wherewithal, you can sign big-time players. It might not be Emil Forsberg, but it can be Luca Orochano out of Brazil. It can be Kevin Denke. It was almost Germán Bertarame. It is Lucho at a different level. Like, I look at what Cincinnati's doing, and I'm just like, our league can get much bigger and much better very quickly if there is a level of commitment and ambition that matches what that club is doing across all fronts. And what's so incredible about it to me is that we spent 3 years rightfully burying them for having no wherewithal, for being completely inept, for being the definition of a loser club. And look what they did in terms of making the right decision in their front office, MLS experience. See what we're talking about, Miami? Making the right decision as far as a head coach to pair with those executives, building out the structure around them, building a stadium, building a training facility that when a Kevin Denke or fill in the blank professional, I don't care at what level, walks into, they say, yeah, I feel at home here. I think I can do my best work here. And then saying, yeah, okay, well, you know, we sold Brandon Vasquez. Then we spent big on a guy who was a bust in Aaron Bupinza. We basically had to take an L on that one, and we turned around and set an MLS transfer record. Like, props to that ownership group, props to that front office, just props to the organization overall of just saying there is a level that we want to reach, and we're not satisfied with where we're at right now. And to me, that's how Major League Soccer grows, when nobody's satisfied. When it's not just like, hey, good season, pat on the back, where we've made it. We haven't made it. What? Everybody else is raising the level. So I want to see more of this. I don't want this to be first time we're talking about it. I hope transfer records are like the points record, and it's just inevitable that it's broken repeatedly year after year after year. And I hope it's not just the Galaxy and Miami and New York doing it. I hope every team in the league looks around and says, yeah, we can go get some of the best players in the world. We might have to get creative about profile and age and location and all that. But, I mean, I just want more of it.
I think you're going to get it. I don't think by the time the 2025 season starts, I don't think that Denke is going to be the transfer record for an incoming player. I think somebody else is going to break that number, maybe even by the end of the month.
Here, here. Let's go.
Now just like keep that. Him away from boxers.
All right. Sheesh. Oh, boy. Let's get into the Audi MLS Cup playoffs conference semifinals. New York City, New York Rebels, Hudson River Derby, Saturday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Vibe check on this one. We have not yet got a Hudson River Derby in the playoffs. And, you know, because the soccer gods are good, there's a little circus in the City Field parking lot. I mean, I don't mean like proverbially speaking. I mean, like there are circus animals and clowns and other such things in between this game. 25,000 capacity for City Field. They've expanded that one. Anders and Sasha are going to be on site for MLS Countdown. And I hear La Previa. So Sasha's going to break out the Espanol, so stay tuned for that one. And there's some extra, a little bit extra spice to this, Kalen, because it's a homegrown affair and not just a bunch of guys who don't truly get what the Big Apple is about. On the New York City side, you got Sands, Hack, Tavon. Kevin O'Toole is a Red Bulls homegrown. He's from New Jersey. Now he's with the New York City Red Bulls, John Tolkien, Edelman. We're going to count the Nealis bros, you know, Long Island, Strong Island, stay strong. Don Core, Julian Hall, etc. This is a treat. It's nice that we got to this point because we definitely did not expect to be here.
Yeah, I did the last New York Derby at Red Bull Arena, and it was one-way traffic. Nick Cushing came out, they switched the formation a little bit in that one. I guess they brought in Perea in that one and then pushed and pressed and within the first 5 minutes scored. And I think they got a second within 10. So that's the way this matchup has gone so far. But I like that extra bit you mentioned of the like homegrown players, because I think that adds a little bit. Even Cushing, he played Justin Hack in that game, and he's like, even in the Cincinnati series, he played him in the home leg and was like, we need somebody who's local, who understands what it means to play for this club here and there. So I actually think it's something that the managers are aware of as well too. And even when I was doing, like, I did a Toronto match earlier this year and against Montreal, and Herdman gave Osorio the team talk. So I think some of this, like, understanding the rivalry part is crucial to actually how this may play out. And some of these guys have, like, Edelman played a huge role in that last series, played some of his best stuff I've seen him play all season. So I love that extra little bit of angle. And some of these guys, as you mentioned, have played for the other side, where even like a Julian Hall started at New York City Academy and then now is like 17 balling for off the bench when he gets his chance. Maybe he has a moment coming off the bench. I'm always rooting for him. O'Toole was a Red Bull player now on the other side for New York City. So some of that bragging rights where you've played against these guys, grown up with these guys, and then now doing it for the first playoff match ever, adds an extra little fun wrinkle that you don't necessarily see maybe in El Trafico or some of these other rivalries.
That 5-1 is going to be playing on the minds of the Red Bulls and New York City as well, I assume, Doyle. I don't think there's a ton of big personnel questions. Maybe like right back for New York City, is it Ilitch or is it Tavon Gray? But outside of that, I struggle to see like a big question mark here for Cushing or for Sandro Schwartz. But I am curious how you think this game is going to play out, because New York City just punched the Red Bulls in the mouth in a Red Bullsian way at Red Bull Arena and just ran out big time winners because of it.
Yeah, they pressed them, and the Red Bulls have changed their game model this year under Sandro Schwartz. We've talked about it a lot this season. Like, they're more willing to play from the back. They're more willing to play small passes through central midfield. It's a massive change in identity, and they were that team up until early October when they lost 5-1 to NYCFC. And since then, they have been much more willing to revert to the old version of Red Bull ball, which is a lot of long balls to the front line and then try to win the second ball in midfield and go direct from there. They have not allowed themselves to be pressed since that game in the way that they were pressed, in the way that they were completely unmade. And you could see that. I mean, part of the change is like they have one center back who can really play with the ball at his feet in Noah Ayla, and he's no longer really a starter, right? It's Reyes and the Nealis brothers. And that tells you a lot about where Sandro Schwartz's head is. And the other thing is with Emil Forsberg, win second ball and then get downhill into space is a really good game plan. Forsberg is so gifted at playing quick passes into the runs of his fellow attackers. And it's been, I'm not going to say irresistible, right? They were pretty fortunate against the Crew, but like, it gives them a better chance of winning the game. And we've seen it play out like that over the first round of the playoffs and the final few weeks of the regular season.
Kaylin, you've done a lot of games in and around New York City this year, and I'm just curious, what is the difference between New York City away and New York City at home? And when I say home, I mean literally any stadium in the New York area, it seems. Like, what is this difference? Because it just seems so stark.
For me, it just comes down to the roster profile, where the age of the team. It's just a young team. And so I think at home, you see one version of them, and on the road, you're not quite sure what you're going to get. And I think part of that comes from the way it's been built. You know, the difference that I think is Maxi coming when he's in the team and not in the team, that seems to be the biggest indicator for me of like at least some experience. He helps them organize defensively, even from the press, and then gives them a release valve to break pressure and then build out from there. So I think some of that just comes down to the age and profile of the team as far as home and away. That'd probably be the easiest answer I could think of.
All right, let's hit some players. Who's got to step up? try to weave this into the narrative of the game and the way you see it playing out, Kalen, who's got to step up? Who's the guy?
I'm going with Santi Rodriguez because it's funny. We did a preview yesterday, Doyle and I did, and it was...
We were working yesterday.
We were working back-to-backs, baby. But I was like, Matt Freeze, right? He's been one of the... he's been an excellent form, one of the best goalkeepers in the league this year. And I was like, Alonso Martinez, and I mentioned the age profile. He's sort of an elder statesman, I think 25 on this team. And it kind of goes to the point of like, you didn't know who was going to step up at times where you have a guy who it's like, you've got Bakrar, you've got a number of like maybes, right? And they had to wait and find. And he had an interesting story where Cushing told me he came and knocked on the door and was like, hey, I want to play the number nine position, which sounds like a number nine to me. And the strange part is now that he is a number nine, I'm like, he didn't never look like a winger, right? Like it does not ever look like he has any interest in going to the wide areas or beating guys off. Like he just wants to stay in those central channels. But Santi was the one we never talked about and didn't really come up. And he's their DP. And so I think they need the best out of him and haven't seen it as of yet. He had, I think, the little chipped penalty or Panenka. But I need to see a little bit more from him in the run of play if they want to get through the series.
I'm going to take Emo Forsberg on the other side. I don't got to add too much to what you said, Doyle. It's just that he does something that nobody else on this roster is capable of doing, and the way that he both slows the game down in critical moments but then speeds it up. He just makes those forwards so much more dangerous in and of itself. His vision, his ability to execute a pass, his ability to just to get away from a guy in tight spaces. And that's what a lot of times the Red Bulls were creating out of against the Crew. It's like, hey, it was a 50-50 ball. Emil won it. He took two or three good touches. He created an angle. Because he's Emil Forsberg, guys started running. And when you start running in front of him, you can bet, look, 7 out of 10 times the pass is going to be on the money. So it's going to be Forsberg. And then you mentioned Freeze, but I think Carlos Coronel's heroics against the Crew. I don't know that he has to replicate them, but if he doesn't, that makes the job much more difficult for the Red Bulls, because I think that New York City are going to have more goal scoring chances in this one than the red side of New York. Doyle, who's your guy?
It's Lewis Morgan, precisely because of what you said. That Forsberg will get him into space, and because NYCFC will have more scoring chances. There are going to be a few of them for the Red Bulls. They're probably going to end up on Lewis Morgan's foot if he's healthy. We've seen that. I think it's reported that he is back in training and expected to be good to go. If that's the case, he's the type of guy who could win this match.
Got to get some goals. It was a little snake pit in the series there against the Crew. All right, that one is going to start us off on Saturday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, MLS Countdown before. Then you'll have a little bit of break, another countdown ahead of the 10:30 match. That's LAFC Seattle Sounders. Vibe check on that one, like this again. I maybe we're all thinking that. Certainly, I would think the Sounders are thinking that, though in a hopeful way. 10 meetings, no wins for the Sounders against this LAFC team. I have a quote here from Anders that I'm not sure he was aware I was writing down during the pre-show meeting. Quote, beating LAFC in 2019 was worth suffering through these last 10 games. Now we're going to beat them, so it's going to be fine. It has to turn out okay this time, right, Kalen? This time it'll change. It'll all be different.
Well, normally I'm like, it's really hard to beat a team, again and again and again. But then there's like a point where you cross a certain threshold where you're like, maybe this is just a bad matchup for this team. I think that is the category that Seattle finds themselves in, where I know there's some questions about will LAFC, which formation will they play? I think they'll stick with the five in the back. And I think it's difficult for Seattle to break down in those positions. So, I think going on the road will be better for Seattle in a way, just because it simplifies things for them as far as their approach. Their defensive structure is strong. And, then you kind of take your moments where maybe you lure LAFC into playing a bit more. But I think the vibe check for this one is that it's probably going to be pretty ugly. Like there's not going to be a lot. We're not going to see a lot of free flowing, beautiful soccer being played. So, but I'm okay with that. As an Eastern Conference loyalist, I'm down to see a bit of that in the Western Conference as well.
As Anders said in the chat, this is like calling next goal wins at recess when you're down 10-1. And it's probably going to be one goal that decides this thing, if history's any indication. Coaching decisions to watch, how the game is going to play out. Doyle, on the coaching decision side, it feels pretty obvious for Schmetzer, whether or not he starts Peter de la Vega, I think might be up for debate, but it's all about Cherundolo's formation and the midfield, right? I heard you say, Kalen, you think it's going to be the 5-2-3, but God, they were so much better in the second half of that third game against Vancouver when they added another number into midfield.
Yeah, they were able to shut Vancouver down in the second half of that third game. And it was, I honestly think that was the only half of that series in which LAFC were the better team. And to Kalen's point about there's probably not going to be a lot of good looking soccer in this one, aesthetically pleasing, the Caps had no problem at all playing aesthetically pleasing soccer against this LAFC team when LAFC left the midfield open in that playing that 5-2-3. And look, the gamble that Steve Cherundolo makes every time that's how they play is that they're not going to lose the game there, and it is worth trading possession and field position for space for Denny Bawanga and Matthias Bogusch and even Ryan Hollingshead to counterattack into. And if you look at the way that LAFC have beaten the Sounders for the past 1,000 years, it's been Denny Bawanga in space or Matthias Bogusch or Ryan Hollingshead in space. The outlier was this US Open Cup back in August, where it was a handball off penalty late that I think Bawanga finished. But like for the most part, it's just been like, we think it's worth trading all of that to get our best goal scorers into high leverage goal scoring positions. And it has worked out that way every single time.
LAFC are obviously a first goal team. We know that, Kalen. Paint me the picture of the first 20 minutes where Seattle comes out and gets the goal that changes the structure and the way that this match looks and maybe the outcome.
I think you just have to look back at the Vancouver tape, and Vancouver had a chance in that first match of the series at LAFC. And they win the ball and they find Brian White in behind, and he hits it off the post one-on-one. But it's the exact type of movement and run that Jordan Morris loves to exploit. And if that goes in, it's different. It's a different series. He had another big chance, I think, in the third game as well. Where
same exact thing.
Same thing. Win the ball, turn and go, find Jordan Morris in space. So if I'm Brian Schmetzer, I'm looking at that tape, and I think it does come down to where Doyle's saying, that midfield where if you pressure O'Brien, if you pressure Tillman, Obed Vargas for me is a key coming into this. If he can win the ball in those positions, and then when you win it, you go quickly, you get the first goal. You cannot concede first to LAFC because they will shut it down. That will be the end, lights out. I just don't see Seattle. And that's the position they've continually found themselves in these past matchups, where it's gone from 1-2 to 3. And just, it has to be, I think it would have to be a 1-0 victory for Seattle, maybe 2-1 if you can find a second, but they have to score first. And I think a chance where LAFC at times, honestly, they looked not quite up for it mentally and moments in the beginning of matches or before halftime. And Cherundolo has talked about this as well, too. So if they can find those moments, they have to be efficient. Jordan Morris had a big chance last year in the playoffs, wasn't able to put it away. They have to take those moments when they arrive. But I think the formula, watching Vancouver, will give them some sort of recipe. And then you're banking on a healthy Jordan Morris. This two-week break may have helped no other team bigger than Seattle coming off that last round, where you have the international break to get guys healthy. I think Rothrock and Rusnak as well should be back into the team. So I think that's actually shaded them to give them a chance to give their best effort, or at least try to change the way this series has gone these last, 10 games.
Doyle, I trust LAFC's difference makers in big moments in the playoffs. They've done it.
Yeah. We all should.
I mean, can we trust Pedro de la Vega? I mean, he's got to be the player to watch and who has to step up here.
You're 100% correct. He is the one who has to step up. He is the player to watch because he is the guy who is probably going to be operating in those half spaces where Ryan Gauld was so excellent for 3 games for the Whitecaps. Like, he has to play better than he ever has in a Sounder shirt, and certainly better than he did against Houston. Because if he comes out and he plays like he did against Houston, like, he will play 45 minutes. He will not
be on the field to start the second half because he was that bad in that series win against the Dynamo. But if you just look at the structure of these teams, it is going to be Pedro de la Vega coming into that half space, finding the ball between the lines, and playing Jordan Morris through. Can he do that? So far this year, the answer is no. If it's not him, then it's Albert Rusnak, and we do have a little bit more confidence in Albert Rusnak's ability to do that, but it's still, you know, Bwanga and Bogusz. And look, Olivier Giroud hasn't been particularly good since he came to LAFC, but we know what Olivier Giroud's record is in big games, and there's just a difference in terms of the quality of the match winners.
I'm going to take Matty Bogusz as the player to watch, and I think the most unpredictable match winner in this game, Denny Bwanga. I'm not saying he is predictable, but we kind of understand where the danger is going to come from, where his starting points are, you know, where he wants to get the ball and how. Bogusz is a little bit more of a wild card to me. He'll pop up in different spots. He'll get in behind you, but he'll also be one to drive at the back line with the ball. He's got the shot from distance. He's been a difference maker in this matchup before. So I think for LAFC, you know probably what you get from Denny. Really, the question is finishing variability and decision-making. Bogusz is the one that if he steps up, I don't think Seattle are going to be able to get the job done. I just think it gets too difficult for them at that
point. Would you start him at the nine or Giroud?
I think he'll start Giroud.
I think he should start Bogusz.
I think if Kiki Oliveira had been playing at a higher level in these playoffs, that it would be easier to make the case for Kiki to play on the right and for Bogusz to play in the middle. I don't know. I just feel like that second half, the way Giroud played, he wasn't as predictable in his movement, and he didn't occupy all the spaces that Bogusz and Bwanga want to get into. But hey, this is the benefit of having a deep, talented roster. Like I wouldn't be surprised either way. I just sort of feel like it's going to be Giroud. I don't know. We'll see.
I would go Bogusz too. I just don't think you can be playing guys into form in the playoffs right now. So I would be happy to have him go into the sort of Gareth Bale role where you're hoping for a change or if you need it. And as the match goes on.
Fair. Who do you got as your player to watch?
I'm going with Obed Vargas. I just think I've always liked him. I have him, I think, in my top three in the 22 under 22 list this year. And I think when we talked about this matchup specifically and winning the midfield in the middle of the pitch, he's going to be integral to being able to do that. So, young player, but he's played in the biggest matches you can possibly play in. CONCACAF Champions Cup winner, all that. Never looks scared of the moment. And I think with the type of match this is going to set up to be, where it's scrappy, you have to win that center of the pitch. And I think he's going to be integral to doing that.
I'll say this on the Giroud one. I was thinking about it as you were going through that. If they go with the 5-2-3, I think you play Bogusz because you need more numbers. You need somebody who wants to drop a little further into midfield. If you play in the 4-3-3, I think you need somebody that's going to occupy those center backs and give Bogusz more space to and time to make those runs and to pop up in those spots. So I think it probably depends on formation, but it's the benefit of having all these great players, man. All right, make your predictions for Saturday. Who you got, Kalen? Eastern Conference, Hudson River Derby, LAFC, Seattle. Who's moving on?
Oh, from both of them?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go, I think the Hudson River Derby is a toss-up, but I'll go to New York City. I think the weight would have helped them more, where the momentum from Red Bulls last series, and the matchup has shaded them as well. So I'll go New York City, and then I'm going to stick with LAFC, although I do see a path for Seattle. I think if you're LAFC, you're looking at the East and saying, okay, well, you know, no Miami, no Columbus. We play home games, single elimination, straight to MLS Cup. This is like a clear path for us. And so I think they'll end up getting through in this one.
I will just say ditto. I think the same thing will happen. Doyle, do you have any disagreement?
Yeah, I'm picking the Red Bulls to go through. I just think they're a different team with Forsberg, and I don't trust NYCFC. I can't do it.
I'm picking LAFC. You can do it.
I'm picking LAFC.
You could do it. Why not? You could do it. Come on. Next goal wins. No. All right. Sunday, 3:30 p.m. Eastern time, Orlando City, Atlanta United. The vibe check is, I mean, for Atlanta, it's just full FEA, middle fingers in the air, you know, Guzan flailing in the net, underdog central, like, you can't stop us now sort of vibes. And for Orlando, there's a little bit of, like, Josef Martinez, Orlando, of, like, is the other shoe going to drop? Because they are the favorites, Doyle. All the pressure is on them, even if maybe the gap between Orlando and the rest of the Eastern Conference teams isn't as big as, say, it would have been with the favorites. This just feels like the moment that Oscar Pereja needs to take advantage of, because he's still chasing cup, man.
Yeah, this is a better team than last year's team. And I know it's counterintuitive to say that, given that last year's Orlando team had 63 points and this one is only 52. But if you look at the underlying numbers, specifically for the second half of the season, since Martin Ojeda became the number 10, they're one of the handful of best teams in the league. And, like, we have seen that repeatedly. Teams that are able to figure it out in June, July are legitimate MLS Cup threats. And that includes last year's crew. They were a different team before and after the Zeller Ion Diego Rossi thing. So the pressure is on them. And I think this is honestly Oscar's best ever chance, or maybe with 2015, but like one of his, no, this is his best ever chance to get to MLS Cup, because they have home field advantage throughout the rest of the Eastern Conference playoffs. If they win this game, they are playing better on balance than anybody else in the Eastern Conference. They, like, I give Charlotte a lot of credit. Charlotte's an excellent defense, and they had no choice but to pack everybody in and, you know, defend in Christian Kalina's lap. And they did a great job of that in the second two games. I don't think Atlanta can do that. So this is it, man. If Orlando blow this, it would be, I think it would be crushing. It would be crushing for them to not get through this game. And honestly, through the next one as well.
And also because it's Atlanta. Now, some questions for Rob Valentino, probably mostly in the midfield. Does Dak start? I think he has to. Is Muyumba able to start again? If he can, you probably want to do that as well. And then for Orlando, it's the same question we've been asking about the number 9. I still expect it to be Ramiro Enrique, just for his movement. And then you have Duncan Maguire and Muriel to bring off the bench. Is this as simple as, like, Atlanta sits deep and counters and Orlando have to break down a block, Kalen? Like, is there anything deeper to sort of the tactical side of this match? How do you see it playing out?
I think that's a good formula. I think you have to stick with the squad that's been playing well. So I think, you know, for me, definitely still riding those vets for Atlanta. And then, you know, the part that I get concerned about for Orlando is a little bit of that caginess, and that kind of just every playoff match with them, it always comes down. I understand how Pereja wants to set his team up and they want to play tight and be in the margins, but that Atlanta United team, as the match goes on, it opens up and it just gets into a little bit of that chaos zone, that's where they're at their best. And so I see that shading towards Atlanta the deeper this goes. So I actually think Orlando should come out and try to set a more aggressive stance. I don't think they're going to do it. But I also I don't think so. I just think the way that they play generally is kind of one way, which is more conservative, especially in these high leverage moments. And I don't see it also as Orlando as such huge favorites to go through the East. For me, the East is just completely wide open at this point. Like, the difference in points, even, I think, in the regular season is, like, pretty minimal. I think they were 2 points higher than New York City and 5 points above Red Bull. So to me, after you get rid of Miami and Columbus, it's kind of just up for grabs as far as who's going to go. And I would include the way Atlanta United, but when you go off and beat Inter Miami 3-0, you can just throw out the regular season at this point. So I'm not as clear as, like, this is Orlando's to lose. And I mean, they lost on decision day at home in a match that they put everything into against Atlanta United in that match.
I didn't feel like they put everything into that match. Like, that was, to me, that was a clear case of Atlanta United playing with desperation and Orlando City not flipping the switch until
they were down 2-0 and it was 30 minutes in. And then the final hour of that match was just one way traffic.
Doyle, I heard you say you don't think so in regards to Orlando being aggressive to Kalen. You think they will be aggressive. Do you think Oscar will press high?
Yeah, I think that it's very likely in this game that Orlando's going to have 60% possession or higher. I think that they are going to, and like part of this is Atlanta's going to be like, have the ball, go ahead. But the kinds of mistakes that Miami's back line made that allowed, TRA in particular to hit those seams and to, get that brace in this, the deciding game. I don't think that Robin Johnson or even, Rodrigo Schlegel are going to make those types of mistakes as often as Miami did. And the other thing is, part of what has made Orlando so good the second half of the season is how comfortable they are in possession and how dynamic they are in changing phase from just like steady possession to attacking penetration in the final third. And that is why Facundo Torres has scored so many goals. It's why, Martino Ojeda has been so effective. Even Angulo has been effective as well. Like, they're creating chances from that type of setup, but they still, because of Araujo and Cartagena, are really tough to break down without the ball. They don't give up, chances up, like counterattacking chances up the gut. I really like the way they're playing. And I understand, like, pointing to the regular season, there's not a big differential in points between this team and, the others in the Eastern Conference. They've lost three times in the past 4.5 months. They've lost three games in 4.5 months since they made the personnel change. Putting Ojeda at the 10 has made them better. Like, the knock-on effect is that it has made them better with the ball, without the ball. It's allowed Cartagena and Araujo to play simpler. It's allowed Facu Torres to be more aggressive, which in turn allows Dagger Dan to be more aggressive up that right side. Like, they're playing really good soccer.
I'm with you on that. I do think that one of the reasons, one of the things Ojeda needs is a little bit more space. Like, I don't think it's as simple as, hey, like, speed things up in the final third. I still think for him and Angulo and Enrique, there needs to be a little bit of space for them to speed up into and to exploit. It's not a team that where they're like, hey, it's very tight here and there's no space between you and the goal scoring areas in and around the box. Like, figure out how to be, to play combinations around that to get there. That's not, to me, where they thrive. So they've got to find a way to get Atlanta to come out a little bit. I do think you're right about that central midfield pairing, and they've got to get around Dax as soon as he gets the ball. Like, that quick release that he played against Miami, you cannot allow that. And that's where the chances come from. So I think they're the favorite, and I think Ojeda is the guy to watch, because if they can get him into space, if they can get him downhill, if they can get him in 1v1 situations where he's got a little bit of pace behind him, he can be really, really good. If you're asking him to be sort of a, like a Reynoso style creator where he receives with his back to goal and turns guys and combines, and that's not him. So they've got to find a way to get Atlanta to come out of their block just a little bit to create that space. Kalen, who's your guy to watch?
Brad Guzan, man.
Let's go.
This guy is on a all-time heater in MLS playoff history right now. He's the player of the tournament. The way it's gone so far. And I did the wild card match in Montreal where it was him and Joseph going toe to toe, which was just epic to watch. And then you basically are like, all right, well, either team from here is just walking into the lion's den about to get just completely mauled by Inter Miami. And it was anything but that. And I think it's fair to say it was because of this guy. And it's not to take away from the rest of the team, but the way we saw him standing on his head literally after he's pushing the net. But in general, just like some of the saves he made were just absolutely ridiculous. And so I just want to see if he can continue it. I think he can. I don't see any reason why he wouldn't be able to ride that. And he's just been, it's just been, he's earned the respect of the best players in the world. Good to see the way they even interacted with him. And I just want to see if he can continue the hot hand.
Speaking of hot hands, who's going to be the hot hand for Orlando up top, Doyle?
I mean, the hope is that it'll be Ramiro Henrique. He's been good at everything in these playoffs except putting the ball in the back of the net. And if there's a concern for Orlando, it's that none of the number nines, and they got three of them, are really wearing their finishing boots right now. But I kind of feel like they're due. Enrique earned that job with his two-way play. You keep it by scoring goals, and he needs to find one here.
All right, goals. LA Galaxy Minnesota finishes off our previews here Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. By then, we'll know who's in the conference finals. We may have a good idea where MLS Cup will be, because if it's El Trafico, we're going to LA for MLS Cup. Vibe check on this matchup. It is overwhelming firepower and LA levels of Ricky Pooj megawatt smiles versus like kind of the nice guys without big names who will shake your hand and smile as they pick you up off the ground after checking you. So, yeah, you know, it's LA versus Minnesota. It's kind of what you think it might be. Coaching decisions to watch. I'm sort of racking my brain here, guys. I kind of feel like this is all pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that is like Marco Royce is not going to start. You know, it's going to be him off the bench. It's going to be the lineups that we've seen from the Galaxy. It's going to be the lineups that we've seen from Minnesota United. I don't think there's anything out of left field happening here.
I do feel, though, like Minnesota have a real chance. And I've been saying this ever since this matchup got set up. It just feels to me like the Galaxy's weaknesses, which is exposing themselves in transition, set pieces, and then the occasional whoopsie, are areas at Minnesota United are very, very good. They're going to sit in that 5-4-1. They're going to take away the middle of the field. They're going to counter through at least Robin Ludd and Yeboah and maybe Bongi from the right side, perhaps Rosales, whoever the moment is right for. And then they're always going to be back in shape, and they're always going to compress space and try to take away the center of the field for Ricky. It feels like this has upset potential, even though I know a lot of people are looking at the Galaxy and just thinking, ah, yeah, let's just roll them. Look at that talent. Look at Ricky's smile. Look at the hair. Perfectly coiffed.
You're not going to mention the tuck?
I didn't feel I needed to, but that is a very important part of the persona. You're right.
I'm with you, Weeby. I think that like styles make fights, and Minnesota's style is, I think, better designed to give the Galaxy problems than certainly Colorado's was. You know, Colorado were dead on arrival even before Bassett and Georgie were hurt in that.
We got a package? Lunch? What do we think? What do we order for lunch?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy.
I don't think that Minnesota are going to expose space in behind for Peck and Paintsil to run into. I think they're going to encourage Ricky to go wherever Ricky wants to go. And to the Galaxy's credit, they have oriented their entire build around that and made it a lot easier for them to cope when he does turn the ball over. And even with the best players in the world, turnovers happen. So the Galaxy are better structured than I think they have been, but at the same time, it's not perfect. Like there are still going to be a couple of turnovers, and when that happens, Kelvin Yeboah, Bongi Longwane, and Robin Ludaldino in the open field, it's killer.
What do you make of Minnesota's defensive record? Do you feel like that's just the core and sustainable and who they are, and or is it more of just like, hey, this is a good run and a little bit fortunate?
I think it's a little bit fortunate. You know, Dane St. Clair has had some big moments. The new guy Diaz has been very good after a rough first game against Seattle. Carlos Harvey has taken like a fish to water, playing as a right center back who steps into central midfield. So they're doing some things. They're certainly not a bad defense. Like they're a very good defensive team. But the Galaxy are maybe the best attacking team in the league. So it's a different level of challenge. It should be. So, you know, thinking about how we framed LAFC versus Seattle, I think this is a game that could end up being weirdly kind of tight and aesthetically maybe something less than glorious, just because there's not going to be any incentive for Minnesota to open themselves up. And that could maybe cause the Galaxy to be a little bit more careful in how they align themselves. On the other hand, again, end up being 5-4 because like Ricky Pooge playing against Will Trapp and Hassani Dotson in central midfield, he's probably going to find some space and going to be able to do some stuff.
Yeah, you would think he'll be able to speed the game up every now and then. This Minnesota team hasn't seen a player like him during this stretch run. So who needs to step up, Kalen? We've already debuted the Little Dino moniker while you were picking up your package or your sub sandwich, whatever's going on there.
I got a Dane St. Clair then, and he has, you know, he has. That's kind of the way you guys set up, like the 5-4-1. I think they've only conceded 2 goals in their last 7 games in that formation. So they've been real tight. Those 4 also across the middle, they're all kind of central guys, so they stay tight, I think. But eventually, like you said, Ricky Pooch, I think, leads the league in touches, leads the league in progressive passes, and this is by far the best attack still available in the playoffs. And so now I'm like, all right, well, you need good goalkeeper play. And Dane St. Clair had a few ridiculous saves early against Diego Luna that I think kept them in that. And then once again, when it came down to the penalty kicks, he had those saves the first run. And I remember I sent him a DM afterwards, like, yo, man, nice. Like great saves and whatever. And he's like, I got more. And then they went back again to penalty kicks. And I was like, oh no, he was not playing. Like he's really doing this. And not to mention the like Vince Carter, it's over. I just love that too. So some personality. I'm ready for a stare down match between him and Ricky Pooch if it does happen on a penalty kick. I'm really ready for that type of answer. So
if it does go to penalties, who's favorite? Dane St. Clair or John McCarthy?
I would go Dane St. Clair for sure. And
I mean, John McCarthy's record in PK shootouts is legit.
MLS Cup MVP, right? But yeah. I think
that's
just
his, his John, as they say.
For Minnesota to be at penalties, they'd be much, much happier to be in that position than the Galaxy would be. So, and I think you guys are over, like, I'm creating a case for Minnesota, but the Galaxy feels slept on to me. Like they haven't really been talked about. I think obviously a lot was in the East, and then now LAFC, and I think the way it went at the last day across line. But they basically haven't even really started their playoffs yet. By the way, that Colorado team was just ravaged by injuries. It was kind of just like,
you know, listen to this,
form, staying fit. So hey, I'm making
Kalen Carr.
Ricky Pooch
standing for the Galaxy, saying this: the Galaxy is an organization.
I don't think it's a bad spot for them to be in.
Slept on.
I don't think it's a bad spot for them to. And look, I still do think LAFC. I'm of the belief the team that have been to Cup Finals, have been in each of those MLS Cup champions. So I think you have to prove it. And the Galaxy didn't do it in Leagues Cup for me. They haven't done it in knockout play. So I want to see what they have, but I do think they're being slept on a little bit as a team that can still win this whole thing.
Joseph Rosales is going to be my player to watch. Also Joaquin Pereira. Those guys are going to be on Gabriel Peck's side. And so being really intelligent about what the positions that you take, when you push forward, how you support the attack, but also stay really, really strategic in terms of your positioning as far as rest defense goes are going to be huge. Because if you get ISO'd against Pack, you basically lose those matchups. And that is something that they cannot afford to let happen. Okay, give us our predictions. Let's get out of here. Sunday predictions, Kalen. What do you
got? I got Atlanta, baby. Let's go.
Oh.
No, I do. I am taking Atlanta. I'm riding it. I'm riding the hot hand. I've seen, you know, I don't know if I'm in the FEA category, but I'd like to get an one match exemption. I believe I'm behind the team. I think this sets up well for them against a sort of tighter, I think, tense Orlando team. You guys have put all the pressure on them. So I'm riding with Atlanta United to continue the dream, and then I'm sticking with the Galaxy.
With your team, your boys.
My boys, absolutely. Yep.
If you could see one thing, it would be the Galaxy to win MLS Cup. That's just like, that's, you know, your dreams. Doyle, what do you got? Any changes from that?
Yeah, I'm picking Orlando. I think the Atlanta dream ends in Central Florida on Sunday, and I really like Minnesota United's chances, but I just think the Galaxy are
oh come
they're
on.
At home. They have more firepower. So yeah, we're going to get El Tráfico.
I'm taking Orlando and I'm taking Galaxy as well. Give me the favorites. All right, big matches Saturday and Sunday. MLS Countdown.
Loons, we expect to see this on your social media this week.
Exactly. Write it down. Write it down. We almost believed in you. Yeah, that's a good quote for you. All right, everybody, enjoy the games. We'll be back on Monday to break it all down. It'll be a great weekend of playoff action on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. We'll see you on the other side. Adios. We'll be right back.